Okay, everybody, welcome to the NABBA Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting. My name is Owen Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. The following reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So tonight's speaker is Terry C. His home group is the How It Works group here at NABBA. We had a short conversation before the meeting started, and turns out Terry has a very interesting combination of skill sets he's developed over his life. Don't know if he'll get into those details while he's sharing his story, but please join me in welcoming Terry.
Hello, everybody. My name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
Thank you for being here and happy Memorial Day. I would like to thank all the people that served in the Army or whatever. Congratulations. We appreciate your work and all those who have sacrificed their lives so that we could sit here today and have meetings without nobody hindering us. And I really appreciate that. You know, I love this country. I love this state. And guess I'll get on into my story. I was we have a birthday meeting here at the end of every month, and Mark told his story, and he done such a good job, and he was wearing a suit, nice suit, and he looked all handsome and everything. And I thought about wearing my suit, and I said, nah, hell no, that ain't me. But you know us alcoholics have these big egos. I told my wife, I told Nicole, I said, you know, I think I've reached the pinnacle of my sobriety. I said, I'm going to be the blue chip speaker. And she goes, man, you need to tone your shit down. You ain't nothing but another drunk. So let me get on with it. My sobriety date is January 13, 2007. I have a little over 9 years sober. And I learned this from Mark. You know, I really believe what happens to us as kids has a big impact on how we are when we're adults. You know, some people, we all come from different homes, and different families, and different religions and stuff like that. We all go through our shit. The thing I like most about AA is none of our stories are exactly alike. And the way we get sober, nobody is even close. I've heard a lot of stories, talked to a lot of people who got sober, and it's all different. It's just a blessing from whatever God you want to choose. I'm going to start off with my childhood. From the time I was a little boy, I guess I can remember. I guess I was about 4 years old. My grandparents raised me and my brother Charlie. And lived out in the country in Sylvester, Georgia. And behind the house were three big lakes. So I grew up fishing. And I grew up hunting. At the time I was big enough to walk, I had a shotgun and I'd go out hunting. I had every kind of little animal you could think of. I had quail, dove, all kinds of different ducks, squirrels, a dog, a cat, I even had a snake. And, you know, it was nice to live like it. It was like a perfect little childhood. And my parents, well, my grandparents, they owned a little restaurant called the Blue Goose Cafe. And they cooked Southern food there. They had this big coolers full of beer. People would come in. Some people would eat. Some people would just drink. My grandfather was an alcoholic. He drank all the time. I can remember he'd open up a beer, and my grandma would pour pepper sauce in his beer. And he would drink it, and he'd just get mad, and he'd just be cussing and going on. But the way, you know, I grew up in a way that everybody had their chores to do. So the way that me and my brother made our money is we'd go out and pull peanuts, pick them off the vines, and my grandma would boil them. So we'd walk around town selling boiled peanuts for a nickel a bag. But I had a problem. I had some friends that loved them damn peanuts so much. And every time I'd see them, they just loved me to death. And it was a whole herd of goats that was down at the sales barn. So I'd go down there to the sales barn, and I'd feed all my peanuts to the goats. And when I come back, I didn't have no money. I'd get a whooping. But the goats were like my best friends. And I would go down there, and this man that owned the sales barn, he had a little stagecoach built, a miniature stagecoach. And I would hook all them goats up to that stagecoach, and I'd get in that seat, and I'd say, "Ha!" And I'd ride around town, and I thought I was the biggest big shot you ever seen in your life. A stagecoach with eight goats for me. But I loved it, and it was good. And, you know, I've seen, you know, I think this has a lot to do with the way I think today. I got a brother named Charlie. Some of y'all know him. And maybe one of these days he'll get this program. But when we were little boys, we went out in the woods, and we had bananas with us. And he said, "Let's roast these bananas." And I said, "No, you can roast bananas." He said, "Yeah, you can." So we're in a pine forest, and he puts some pine straw together and lights it on fire and gets a stick to roasting his banana. And the next thing I know, the whole damn woods are on fire. We burnt down about 30 acres of wood, pine forest. So on the way back home, there was a police officer that lived on the end of the street, and I was trying to go there to tell him, you know. But my brother kept pulling me, saying, "No, no, no, let's go home." So we went home, and we're sitting in front of the TV, and my grandma was there, and the fire truck went by. And she said, "Don't y'all want to go see the fire?" And we said, "Oh, no, we don't want to go see the fire." You know, but, from that moment, I guess later on in life, you know, when something happened, I never would call the police or go tell anybody. So, you know, we used to sell. The first real violence that I seen came from my grandfather. I went down to the tobacco barn where they sell the tobacco, and the guy, the auctioneer, you know, that goes, hey, 35, 45, you know, him and a group of men were standing around, and I went up to him and I said, "Y'all want to buy some peanuts?" I guess I was about 5 or 6 years old, and he said, "Don't nobody want to buy them damn peanuts. Your grandma pisses in the pot. She cooks them in." So that hurt my feelings. So I went back to the restaurant, and I was crying. And my granddaddy said, "What happened?" So I told him. He grabbed me by the arm and said, "Take me, show me which guy said that." So we go down to the sales barn, and I said, "That's the man right there, Grandpa." My grandfather pulled a pistol out of his pocket and shot that man 3 times. Must have been a small caliber pistol. That man was running through his car, and every time he'd get hit with a bullet, he'd get up. He got in his car, and he hauled ass, and nothing ever happened to my grandfather. Never seen that salesman again. But I can remember, my grandfather was a bad alcoholic. And he had, his liver gave out, and he had gangrene in both legs. And I remember I went to the hospital, me and my brother and my grandma. We was there in the hospital room with them, and the doctor said, you know, we may be able to save you if we cut your legs off. And my granddaddy looked at that doctor and said, I would rather be a dead man than half a man. And he died in that hospital room. And I would go to the restaurant and get beers, cans of beers, and take them to the hospital room where he was at, where he could drink a beer, and he would tell me that you're the only one that loves me or cares about me. And he passed on. I guess when I was about 10 or 11 years old, my father came down to South Georgia and he picked me and my brother up, brought us up to Atlanta. He dropped us off at Capital Homes, right across the street from Grady Hospital. 75 was the two-lane highway then. And it was a totally different world from a little boy that was hunting and fishing, playing with goats, and riding on a little wagon train. I went out in the neighborhood, checking out the neighborhood, and I walked up to a kid and I said, hey, how you doing? He stabbed me in my stomach. And from there on, it was on. I had to learn. I had to get into had to join a gang in order to survive. And it was rough. It was, you know, there wasn't all that crack and all that stuff. People were just mean as hell. You know, there was heroin addicts and stuff like that. But the whole neighborhood was nothing but, you know, drunks, addicts, and prostitutes. You know? And it was just such a hard change for me to make. So I had to get, you know, I joined a gang. You know, that was the only way I could survive. You couldn't walk through the housing projects by yourself. If you did, you got beat up. And it was rough. It really was. It was a terrible place. I honestly believe, you know, you go to a good subdivision where nice homes are and ask the kids there, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? They'll say a doctor, a lawyer, I want to be a police officer. You go down there to them housing projects and ask the kid what he wants to be when he grows up, and he'll tell you. He wants to be the dope man. He wants to be a kingpin, because that's all they know, and that's all that I've seen. You know, I'd see them guys ride through there in them Lincoln Continentals with the suicide doors, pretty girl, and they got money and everything else, and that's what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, I wanted to be in the mafia. I wanted to be one of the guys. You know, talk a little bit about my mother and father. You know, when I came up to Atlanta from South Georgia, I had three brothers and sisters that I'd never seen before. They were born up here while I lived down there. My mother had 5 sons in 7 years. One of my brothers died, I guess when he was about 3 or 4 months old. My poor mama's body never got time to recover. And the only time I seen my father, and I never called him Daddy, I always called him by his name, Bo Cantrell. See him about every 6 or 7 months. He was a truck driver. He was illiterate, he couldn't read, and he couldn't write. My mother, I knew something was kind of strange about her. I couldn't figure it out. But she had schizophrenia. Today she's been diagnosed with schizoaffective, where you hear voices and see things. She went and got a shotgun from a store, from a gun shop. She hears these kids out in the woods. This woman's got these kids out in the woods. All these kids will have names. And she was going to go out in the woods and kill this woman to save the kids. I told my baby sister, I said, don't y'all realize them kids are us. That's the kids that she's trying to save. I took that shotgun back to that gun shop, brand spanking new, and I really believe that we need some kind of gun control. The guys wouldn't buy it back from me. They said they would give me a quarter of what it was worth. I think she paid like $400 for this shotgun. And I said, buddy, I said, my mother has schizophrenia. How can you sell her a shotgun? He said, I don't care if they're mentally retarded. If they can pass a background check, I'll sell them a gun. I called the police and there was nothing they could do about it. You know, while I was in the projects growing up, I learned to steal. There was times where I had to go to the grocery store and steal food for my little brothers and sisters. I can remember times that we lived on nothing but potatoes alone. If we had some butter or something to put in with the potatoes, we were doing good. And that sorry father I had was nowhere to be seen. So I would go in the grocery store and I'd steal hot dogs and stuff like that. And I went to this one grocery store and I believe the man and woman that owned it knew what I was doing, but they didn't say nothing to me because they knew I was trying to feed my younger brothers and sisters. My older brothers were always gone. They were never around. So that left me to watch after my little brothers and sisters. You know, as I was in that gang, I started robbing and stealing. We was doing, and we're getting on up there. The cops were always on us. My street name was Suspect. That's what everybody called me. Cops were always getting us. We was some pretty bad guys. You know, we figured out how to go on top of a drugstore and cut the roof open and go down in the drugstore and get all the drugs out, get all the pain pills and diet pills out. And we've done that quite a bit. Until then they got smart and they started putting burglar alarms in them. But back in the day, they didn't have alarm systems in them, just on the front door. So I went from, you know, I was stealing all kinds of stuff and I was getting in trouble. And so me and my buddies in the game, we all decided that the cops were on our ass hot and heavy. So we all decided we were going to go, and all of us was going to join the Army on the buddy system. So we all go up there and fill out the paperwork. We come back a couple of days later, and the recruiter goes, well, you know what? He says, the only one that can pass the test, background check to get in is Terry. He said, the rest of y'all can't get in. We don't want you. So they said, well, if we can't go, you're not going to go. And I said, bullshit, I'm going to go. So when I was 17 years old, I had my mother sign me into the Army. So I went off to Fort Jackson. You know, in the Army, when I was in the Army, it was easy. I had two drill sergeants while I was at Fort Jackson. One drill sergeant was a black dude named Drill Sergeant Stewart. And we had a white guy named Sergeant Hines. Stewart was a down-and-out alcoholic. We were supposed to be going on a 30-mile march. We'd go sit down in the woods and get drunk all day long. Then when we had Sergeant Hines, he'd just drill us to death, you know. So I made it through boot camp. From boot camp, they sent me down to Fort Polk, Louisiana. This is right at the end of the Vietnam War, fall of Saigon. So we go down to Fort Polk and we train for Vietnam. They had rice paddies and all that down there. So I finished AIT. We're all getting ready to go to our duty stations. So they put us all on a plane, and we don't know what our orders are. We never got no orders. And they said, your orders will come. So we winded up in Germany. And they took 400 of us and put us in a prison, in an old Nazi German prison. But the doors had no locks on them. And they trained all of us to be border guards. And they trained me to be on a recovery team. And this is at the height of the Cold War. So we got our training. We trained for about 6 months. And they sent us out there on the border. And we lived on the border. We had tents. We had A-frames, wooden floor with A-frame tops. Dropped the tent over. And you know, I'm nothing but old Southern boy. When it started snowing up there, it got cold as hell. And snow got that deep on the ground. And a lot of them guys were old Vietnam vets. and it's freezing outside. We got a little potbelly stove that you hook a diesel can up to for heat. And these guys are sitting around and they're sweating and rubbing their noses. I go, what the hell are you guys doing? I mean, how can you stand to be around in a t-shirt? They said, we're doing heroin. And that's, I started, I got addicted to heroin. I was doing it recreational, but you know, it still had an effect on me when I got out. But there were so many drugs, we could get anything we wanted. You could go to the drugstore and get liquid speed in a bottle for like 10 marks. Yeah, and we'd do that and stay awake. And, you know, the border was, it was hairy. It was real bad. You know, between the CIA and the State Department and the KBG, you know, you're right there on the border. They got their people, their spies coming over. We got our spies going over there. And my job was, if we would go, when these spies would go over and they would pick a doctor or it might be a scientist or whatever up, we would go meet them and bring them back across the border. I seen a lot of blood where people would try to go across the border and they would gun them down and drag their bodies back across. You know, you think about the border and all that. This was nothing like the Berlin Wall where they had the fence all the way up. The border had markers, little concrete markers that stood about that tall. And they had different colors on each side of it. And you would know what country you was in. Because I worked in a place called the Kronach Tip. That's where East and West Germany, Poland, and Czechoslovakia all came together at one point. So you had to watch the markers. You could be in a... over on the Russian side if you wasn't careful. So, I'd done that for a while. I finally made sergeant. And when I made sergeant, I became the biggest dope dealer the Army ever seen in their life. I was able to go to Frankfurt and pick up all the hash and everything else and bring it back. In my tent, you come in my tent, we had coolers full of beer all the time. And, at one time, I had more experience on the border than anybody else. And I had an incident where I got hurt really bad. And I can't blame nobody but myself. You know, you get all these 18-year-olds and 19-year-old guys together and you say, here's an ammo dump. Get whatever you want out of it. And we had landmines and fuses. And I figured out you could take one of them fuses and wrap it around a tree and set it up, hit it with the charger, and just the fuse alone would blow the tree down. So one day, me and the sergeant was walking around, the platoon sergeant, we were coming around, and these guys had taken all the C4 out of landmines and dug a hole and put them in the hole. They put a couple 5-gallon cans of diesel fuel in there. We come walking around, they set that damn thing off, and the concussion from it was so strong that it picked me up and threw me about 90 feet in the air. And when I landed in a foxhole and I split the disc, two vertebrae in my back. I went to the hospital, gave me a little treatment, you know, a little massage thing and stuff like that. So when I got ready to go back on duty, two of my buddies came pick me up. One of my buddies, I have to say his name was Bazelvar. He was a black dude from Texas. And he was the first cowboy I ever met in my life. And this man was a gung-ho cowboy. He rode horses and bulls and all that. And he was one tough dude. He really was. He was something else. But anyway, they've been drinking. I'm sitting in the back of the Jeep. And they're going in. We had all the old Jeeps. We didn't have that nice Hummer shit they got nowadays. These were ragged stuff. And I'm in the back seat of this Jeep, and they're going around these dirt roads, you know. We're up and around mountains and stuff like that. And they flipped the damn Jeep, and it threw me out of that Jeep, and I tried to hold on, and it broke both of my shoulders. So, over the years, I've had three back surgeries. I've had 7 surgeries on my shoulders. And it just... But, you know, when you're a young man, you recover from that stuff. But when you start getting old like I am right now, believe me, that stuff be hurting. Especially when it gets cold. Okay, I got out of the Army. I've done another 2 years at Fort Gillem in the Reserves. And the whole time I was doing that, I was getting way back into alcohol and drugs and everything. And, you know, I had figured out a long time ago when I lived in the projects, the bigger stuff that you steal, the more money you can get. So I became an expert at giving people the combo. And the combo was a dump truck, a lowboy trailer, a backhoe, or a bulldozer. I could make a lot of money doing that. And I made a lot of money stealing heavy equipment. And they would send it to another state, take it apart, use the hydraulics off of it or whatever. So I always liked doing the big things. And I wasn't into robbing somebody's house or something like that. And I never really wanted to affect any, you know, take something away from some family, because my family never had nothing. So I stowed heavy equipment. You know, I was a... I'd steal the stuff and get a pocket full of money, and I was a little, I guess you say, a small-time coke dealer. And I was, selling little 8-balls and grams and stuff like that. And I was downtown Atlanta at Alice Cooley's Ballroom, and I met a man down there, and I was giving cocaine out and acting like I was the big shot and all this when I really wasn't shit. And this dude came up to me and says, "Man, you know, I like your style and all this." And he said, "You know," and we got to talk. And he said, "Well, you know, I got 2 cousins that live in Miami." He said, "They have law enforcement. They told me if I need any drugs, come on down there." So we went down to Miami, and I think we had about $400 or $500, and they gave us like 2.5 pounds of cocaine. From that point on, it was on. I became a big-time drug dealer. I was selling ounces, half pounds, pounds, whatever you wanted. I could cut it twice and still have plenty of a good dope. So it just kept rolling. My buddy, he was a bad alcoholic. So you know what us criminals, you know what us criminals call going to work, don't you? Going to work is when we're going out to steal something or to sell drugs. That's what we call going to work. So I would go to work, and I'd come home, and his girlfriend and all their friends would be there, and they just doing all the cocaine. So we got into a big fight about that. I beat his girlfriend up. I beat him up. I left. I came back a couple of days later, and I went in the bathroom. And I done a big shot of cocaine. And when I opened the door to walk out of that bathroom, that man stabbed me in my throat. And we got to fighting. He had the upper hand for a little while. And when I finally got the upper hand, for some reason, God forgive me, I showed no mercy. I killed that man. I'm responsible for the loss of another human being's life. And I regret that with all my heart. Cops came. I had to go to Grady Hospital. I was in Grady Hospital for a while. I was in DeKalb County's old jail. They didn't have the new jail then. And I was in solitary confinement. And I had got a good lawyer. Paid a lot of money for a lawyer. And I was going to get a sweet deal. I think I was going to get 5 years and 5 years probation for all the drugs and everything, and for the manslaughter charge. And they called me, took me back to the courthouse. I went, seen the district attorney, and I seen the judge, and they said, "You know, we're going to have to rescind on the deal that we're going to give you." And I go, "Why?" I said, because the NAACP is suing DeKalb County because black men are getting more time than white men. And they're watching your case, and they're watching another case. And I was like, what the hell does the NAACP got to do with me? And I harbored a resentment so bad. So I had to go before a different judge, and I went before Judge Siegler, and I never will forget it. It was the scariest day of my life. And up there during the trial, and Judge Siegler says, do you have his arrest record? And the district attorney said, yeah, I have it. You know them big sheets of paper that come out of the fax machines? You know? He took that damn thing and folded it out. It went about 20 yards that way. And I was like, oh shit, this ain't going to be good right here. And it sure wasn't. You know, I winded up with 2 15-year sentences. Went to prison. I put an appeal on, but it didn't do no good. It takes a long time for all that. But I'd done 6 years in prison, and they granted me parole. But they put me on high max parole. So I got out of prison. I wanted to do right. I went to 8111, started going to meetings. I'd done good for about 7 8 months. I'd screw up. I wouldn't report. I'd go in there to take a urine test. They said, we're going to give you a urine test. And I said, for what? I'm going to fail it any damn way. So they sent me back to prison. I come back out of prison. Went back to 8111. And here's what God done for me. He made me watch and realize. I watched a young lady come into 8111 by herself, and I watched a young man come into 8111 by herself. And they got right in the middle of the bed. I love it when you see people get just right into it. They just get right into the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. I watched both of them, met them. I screwed up again. They sent me to prison. I got out of prison, went back to 8111. This man and woman done got married. I stayed sober for a little while, screwed up, and they sent me back to prison. I came back. This man and woman done bought a house, done had a baby. Life is good. They're happy. Went back to prison, came back out again. I done that 5 times. Back and forth. Couldn't leave the alcohol and drugs alone. I'd get 10, 11. One time I got 11 months and 29 days of relapse. Just couldn't get it together. On my last trip to prison, which was my 6th time, I had stolen an 18-wheeler that was loaded with clothes. When we stole the 18-wheeler, we got the truck driver drunk and paid a girl to get him drunk and all that. Stole his truck and got away with it. I went and parked the trailer somewhere and put the truck somewhere else because, you know, they got that GPS shit on it now. And anyway, my buddy goes back up there and they go, well, there's one of them right there. So he told on me. The cops came and kicked the door into my motel room. I'm in there getting high and drunk. So I go back to DeKalb County Jail. And in a way, it's the best thing that happened to me. I went back before Judge Siegler, and he said, they came up with a plan. They said, tell you what, we're going to kill your old sentence and give you a new sentence. We're going to give you 5 years, 3 to do in prison, 2 to do on probation. All right, I never really ain't got a choice. So I went back to prison for the 6th time. I got out of prison, and I was on probation. I wasn't on parole. And I was doing pretty good. I bought me a nice Chevrolet pickup truck, a brand new one. Had a good job, making good money. And I guess I'd been doing good for about, I don't know, close to a year. And for some reason, I decided I was going to go drink and drug again. So I was downtown Atlanta. I was drunk. Took a big old blast, crack cocaine. I was geeking out like you wouldn't believe. And I come over this hill, and a line of cars was stopped, and I hit a car in the rear end so hard. This was one that didn't kill the lady in it. I left the scene of the accident. I went across the bridge, and I went into a service station. I knew I was in trouble. So I got all the beer cans and all the dope out of my truck, and I throwed it in the garbage can. And I called the cops. And then the cops come up there. And when the cops got up there, they questioned me. And all the people go, "Look in the garbage can, officer. Look in the garbage can. We seen them throw that stuff in the garbage can." So I was arrested for DUI, possession of drugs, leaving the scene of the accident, hit and run, the whole nine yards. I went to the city of Atlanta jail. And I knew that AA worked. I had seen the proof of the pudding through that man and that woman. I had heard that meeting makers make it. I got in that cell, and I just knew I was going back to prison for the seventh time. And I was heartbroken. I hated prison. You know, let me tell you a little bit about prison. My behavior in prison was so bad, they sent me to a prison called Hayes Prison in North Georgia. Half the prison population, 95% of the prison population has a life sentence with no parole. So when you're out there playing basketball with somebody, and you say, "You fouled me," and they look at you, and they get all mean. You know, it's hard to reason with a man who has two life sentences in 400 years. You know, they don't care. If they die, they die. It's just a quick way out of prison. They're never going to get out of prison. It was rough. Prison's not a pretty place. It really isn't. I've seen a lot of people get killed and hurt bad in prison. So anyway, I'm sitting in this cell. I got on my knees. And I said, "Lord God, I don't know what's going to happen to me. But if I ever make it back out of prison, I will go to AA and I will do exactly what them people tell me to do." And I really believe that was the first time in my life that I had got on my knees and prayed to God and was sincere about it. From that moment on, miracles started happening in my life. You know, I had a great resentment against the NAACP because I didn't think it wasn't fair. You know? But the truth of the matter of fact was, black men were getting more time than white people were. I had to accept that. I got this beautiful young black woman who was my attorney, court-appointed attorney. She came and talked to me, and she was new. She was a new lawyer. Well, boy, she was good. She was really good. I hope today that she's a judge somewhere sitting on a bench. I went to court. She told the judge, she said, "Well, where are the witnesses at?" "I was just here," says somebody found some drugs in a garbage can. You know, and this, that, and the other. And I was able for the first time in my life to walk out of that courtroom. I didn't even have to go back to jail. I walked out of that courtroom. I went to 8111. I went to them people down there, and I said, "I'll tell y'all what." I said, "I'll do whatever y'all tell me to do. I don't care. I'll do it." They said, "The first thing you got to do is hand the keys over to your truck." I said, "For what?" They said, "Your truck is your co-conspirator." So I did it. I gave them the keys to my truck. And I rode MARTA and worked in a car wash for about 9 months. I later on got a job with a guy. He's in recovery. And I was doing pretty good. And I got a huge job. I got a job with the Theater of the Stars. They're with Fox Theater. They had a big warehouse over at the park. and I was doing all the props and stuff for them. And then they wanted me to build a big office building for them. But I was so young in sobriety, I didn't need, you know, we're talking $200,000 here. I didn't need that pressure. So I gave the job to my buddy and told my buddy I would work for him. And I worked for $12 an hour. I probably could have made at least a good $25,000 or $35,000 off that job. But I didn't care about that. The only thing I really cared about was getting sober. I had had enough of the prisons and everything else. I've learned. You know, when I was in prison, I did study sociology. Gives you a lot of knowledge on background on how people are brought up, different religions, peoples in different countries and everything else. And I've learned that I'm not responsible for what happened to me as a child, but I am responsible for what I do and I'm done. And it makes a big difference. Once I was able to get that down, you know, I kept going to meetings. Tim Moore is my sponsor. He's got more time than me, but I had met him when he first came in. When I met him, I had went back to prison one more time. But I remember him coming in, and he was one of those people that I love to see who comes into the program, and they get right in the middle of the bed. They're ready to do the work. They're willing. Yeah, and there ain't nothing better than that when you see that. It's just the promises coming through. I was so afraid. I got a year. I was going on close to a year of sobriety, and I was working, building them office buildings. And I got a bad burning sensation in my chest. And I thought I had acid reflux or something. But it went on for 3 days, and it was just burning like crazy. And I was living in a halfway house. So I got up and I went to the hospital, and I said, you know what? I told the lady at the hospital, I said, you know, I don't think I got pancreatitis. I used to drink real heavy. So they did a test on me. I came back in there and goes, no, sir, you ain't got pancreatitis. You're having a heart attack. Come to find out, I have coronary artery disease. If I'd have still been drinking and still using drugs, I would have died. Ain't no doubt about it. I've had two more heart attacks since then. And it's, you know, it's really not that bad. Since I've been sober, I mean, really, I go in there, you know, they stick a rod up your leg or through your arm or something and go inside your heart and blow it up and put a stent in there. I got 12 stents in my heart. You're in and out of the hospital. And it's amazing. It's amazing how my attitude is. See, today when I go into the hospital, I've got an attitude of recovery. I remember my first heart attack. You know, they done my little surgery on my heart and everything. I felt better. You know, after everybody has a little surgery, they send you into this conference room with a dietitian, you know, about your food and stuff like that. And I got up and I shaved and got my clothes on, and I walked into that room, and them other people sitting in there looked like they was about dead. I was like, wow. Yeah, and they had the same damn surgery I had. But there was a big difference. I had an attitude of recovery. And I think it that makes a big difference in whatever we do, whatever job we have, or how our health is. If you have that frame of mind that you're going to take that on the same damn way that we took our drugs and alcohol on and got sober, we can overcome it. You know, all of us, we're overcomers. You know? We've overcome a lot of stuff. You know? I've been sober, 9 years, 4 months now? It's been the best years of my life. The best years of my life. The 9-step promises just keep coming and coming and coming. Things just get better and better. You know, I was always alone by myself. Today I got a little family. I got friends who care about me. I got my family here at Nava. You know, I love coming up here. I came up here today. We had a little barbecue. You know, I love my friends up here. You know, if something is weighing heavy on my mind, or if I got to make a decision and I don't know much about it, somebody in this clubhouse does. All I got to do is go get their advice. You know, we come from all different walks of life. Police officers were lawyers, were doctors, you know, and we all fit together. We're all the same. You know, I honestly believe that anybody, I don't care what color, race, religion you are, everybody is entitled to recovery. And if I'm there, the hand of AA needs to be there. You know, and that's one reason we tell our stories. You know, it's, as bad as my story is, I've even heard worse. I've known people that went through a whole lot more. I hate to say this, but I know two women, and what I'm about to say is horrible, but it's the truth. I know a woman who got sober. She had a baby. She got drunk and passed out. Didn't nothing bad happen. The baby was fine, but that was enough for her to get sober. I know a woman, I heard her story. She had a baby. She got so drunk, and she was cooking. She accidentally put her baby in the oven and went to prison for that. Can you imagine? You know, I've been in plenty of blackouts. I'm grateful that I didn't run into some family or some kids and kill them. I can remember pulling up in the driveway and never knowing how I got there. You know, it's a godsend. You know, every time that I think that things are bad, all I got to do is do a gratitude list, and things will get better. I've learned since I've been in AA, we all got problems. We all put our problems on this desk up here. You see everybody else's problems, you want to pick yours up and put them back in your pocket. You know, it's a great journey. You know, I spent all the time, I'm nearly 60 years old. I spent a third of my life in jails and prison. If I can go 20 years sober, I'll be so ever grateful to a God of my understanding. I never had a God. I didn't know what God was until I came to AA. You know, I was so, I just didn't know nothing much about religion. I had to ask the people in AA to teach me how to pray. Today I can say my prayers on my own, and they work. You know, sincere prayers go a long ways with God. The foxhole prayers ain't worth a shit. You know? So I thank all of you for being here. That's my story. God bless each and every one of you.
Well, thank you, Terry. We talk about progress, not perfection, but for me that was perfection. What comes to mind is one of the promises, thank you, where it says, we suddenly realize that God was doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. That's what I got out of your story tonight. Thank you. That's Tinsley to come up and do the chips.
Woo-hoo! Chip time! I mean, Tinsley, I'm an alcoholic. And that was a great story, Terry. I really enjoyed that a lot. That's some heavy shit, to tell you the truth. But anyway, and so is AA. Some heavy shit here. I tell you what, we got a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life, one day at a time, we offer the white chip. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip? Anybody else for a white chip? 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody got 90 days for a red chip? About 6 months. Anybody got 6 months? Green chip for 9 months? Blue chip for years or multiples? I'm going to offer the white chip one more time. You can for the chips you hold.
Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight.
somewhere strange to me. As I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's kin.